from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but just don't work on you.
I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Today, it's official. Americans are stupid. From economic collapse, I'll be sharing with you how stupid are we? Well, it'll be fun because I'm going to give you a test. Let's see how many people in this audience can pass it. Oh, by the way, it's an eighth grade examination from Bullitt County Schools. So that should be easy, right? Eighth grade. So I'm going to give you a test. Also, Partners in Stupidity and the War on Terror, John Acheson from Common Dreams. U.S. jails are warehouses of sick, poor, and low-risk people. Why are we putting people with mental conditions in jails in solitary confinement? Also, there's a new government draft that we'll report here on the program about a national adult immunization plan. This is a 46-page report published in the Federal Registry from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that wants to make sure that you, every one of you adults, get multiple vaccines. So I'll tell you how that's coming. Also, California allows children as young as 12 years old to be vaccinated without parental consent. That's according to AB 499. And Dr. Richard Pan co-sponsored a new proposal out there, Senate Bill 277. So that he simply wants to remove the personal belief exemption to vaccinations. So what happens when doctors become lawmakers? Medical tyranny in California. California is already one of the most tyrannical states in the United States when it comes to forced vaccination policy. We'll get into that. Also today, Coca-Cola caught paying health leaders to say soda is a healthy snack. Really? And I'm continuing with our series on fascism in America, showing you another example. A young boy suspended for a year and prosecuted for bringing a leaf to school. I kid you not. From the Activist Post, Carrie Wedler, an 11-year-old boy, had just a regular leaf, you know, like a oak leaf that we all, when we're, at least when I was in school, one of our projects was we had to collect different leaves and dry them and identify them. Well, he had just one leaf. Teacher thought that it was marijuana. It wasn't. It was tested three times. Didn't stop the teacher or the school or the prosecutor from prosecuting this young boy. That is fascism. And it's rampant, rampant in the United States. But I'm going to keep sharing this with you. Also from Dmitry Orlov, the landscape of U.S. failure, financial collapse leads to war. Last evening, I wanted to see how the pundits were handling the latest, and I'm seeing them ratcheted up. And the ultimate inquisitor, the man who is probably angry at the world because he wasn't born in 1296 or adult then where he could have led the Crusades. He would have been perfect, Bill O'Reilly. So he keeps having these so-called Democrats on last night from the Council on Foreign Relations. You know, the good Democrat, the war-loving monger. Well, he's talking about we need ground troops. We need to invade. We need to go in there. Into Iran? You think that's a good idea? Okay. Let me share a different perspective today. The likely outcome if you get any further into that mess. And also today in the second part of our program, Ben Hewitt. Now, Ben lives an interesting life. Ben and his family live in Cabot, Vermont, where they purchased an overgrazed pasture, a neglected woodlot, but made it into a thriving homestead, producing nutrient-dense foods with permaculture design and relying upon wildcrafting and regenerative agriculture. The property is powered by a windmill and solar panels. The Hewitts currently produce 90% of their food needs, and we're going to find out today about thinking of leaving urban and suburban America to homestead. Well, there are pros and there are cons. And I believe that if you know what you're doing and how to do it, and you transition properly, it's great. If not, you're going to come back to the city or the suburbs with a massive amount of problems, debt, and probably a lot of poison ivy scars. So let's get it right. That's what we're going to face today on the show. If we can do more, we will, because I have a lot more to share. Let's begin. The latest on health and healing. From Colorado State University, a study links stress to chromosomal damage. This is a good study. This is not the only study showing that when you're stressed, you change your chromosomes. Now, we know that stress hurts us. I think we've all seen the pictures of people in positions of power, and a few years after they've got that power, you start to see them age prematurely. Hair turns gray, get wrinkles, their whole demeanor changes. Stress does that to you. But also de-stressing can do just the opposite. You can take a person that is just bound up, their muscles are tight, they can't just relax, and through proper de-stressing, their whole body starts to relax. Well, a new wildlife preserve in India recently became a laboratory for Colorado State University researchers who studied not endangered animals, but villagers displaced by the preserve. They found that such stress takes a measurable toll on their health. Jeffrey Snodgrass, an anthropology professor, led the interdisciplinary team that measures resident stress using tools that range from saliva tests for elevated levels of certain hormones and interviews. They also took samples of cells from inside villagers' cheeks to analyze how stress affected their chromosomes and what are called telomeres. Now, as you know, telomeres are the protective caps. Visualize a telomer as you have a shoestring. In the end of the shoestring, you've got that little piece of plastic that keeps it from fraying. That would be considered your telomere. Now, as long as the telomeres are strong and as long as they're elongated, that cell lives longer. Now, when you start doing things that speed up the aging process, for example, anything that's pro-inflammatory speeds up the aging process. It also creates oxidative stress. Now, here's the irony, but I want to put this in proper context. Most exercise creates oxidative stress. Well, that would be a negative to the cell. But it's also very positive in all the other things it does. So it's still negative to the cell. You can still prematurely age yourself by exercising, and especially marathon and long-distance training. But as long as you compensate by taking the antioxidants that trap the free radicals that are created with the oxidative stress, then it's a double positive. You get all the benefits, lowered pulse rate, lowered blood pressure, lower cholesterol, better digestion, good hormones, all of that. Stronger muscles, more human growth hormone, better musculature for men and women, especially over 40. And you don't get any of the downside because vitamin C, vitamin E, coenzyme Q10 have trapped the free radicals of the oxidative stress, so you get all good. So now, imagine that the reason you're going to live a longer age is because you're going to put living, alkalizing foods and juices into your body, supplements, and that will allow the telomeres to be elongated. But if you start eating the pizzas, the french fries, the hot dogs, the soft drinks, the caffeine, the alcohol, and the stress, that shortens the telomeres. All that protein you eat from animal sources, it shortens the telomeres. Hence, that's what causes us to age and get diseased. So the researchers were involved in two villages in India, one that was relocated from its river valley to nearby plains to create room for a new preserve for endangered lions, and another on the edge of the preserve that wasn't moved. And what they found was that the relocated villagers demonstrated real high levels of stress, and the ones that weren't moved didn't. So, quote, we don't usually think about conservation displacing people. In this case, we ask whether stress could actually injure people deeply and shave off years of their life. Our findings support the idea that stress is linked to cellular damage, end quote. The study's title is Stress and Telomere Shortening Among Certain Indian Conservation Refugees. It was published in the current issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Now, let's extrapolate for a moment. And this is where I'm hopeful some of the people in this audience will get this message. I had a person yell at me once, a friend, for being stupid. And his comments were, by any measure, completely justified. I had made a decision not to do a business, and this person was raged. He was livid. Of course, he would have benefited from this by getting a finder's fee of 5%. And today, that deal would have earned me over $1 billion, with a B, a billion. I know that for a fact because the person who took the deal when I rejected it made over $500 million before he died by slipping on some ice and smacking his head and having an aneurysm. I chose not to. I will not go into the reasons why, but I believe I would have had to have compromised in levels I would not and did not want to. And I just said, I don't want that stress of knowing right now I can go to bed at night knowing I haven't compromised on anything. I'd rather not do something than to do it compromising myself, period. And of course, all the people say, but look at the money and look at this and look at that. And I said, I don't have to look at any of that. All I have to do is look in the mirror and be able to smile because I'm not engaged in anything that I would not be proud of. I will not go further in explaining it than that. That is not the first time that has happened in my life. I have turned down a lot of deals, television programs, networks, staying at ABC Network. I could have done all that. I chose not to. Why? Stress and distress. Why is that? Because, now here's where you got to listen carefully to understand the context of what I'm saying. More often than not, most of our decisions in life come from our subconscious. Even we think we're being conscious. Because what we're not aware of is the power of the subconscious to produce our justifications, rationalizations, excuses, and then to defend them almost with a radical sense of self-righteous indignation and rightness. We know we're doing the right thing because we feel it. But what if those feelings are not real? What if those feelings are coming from subconscious conditioning that we're not even aware of because it's subconscious? And a lot of people are insecure because of, at some point in their early life, they did not get the unconditional acceptance and love to make them feel enough to be accepted. So they're always overcompensating. And the high-level achievers, many, not all, are always overcompensating. So no matter what they achieve, they're never happy. I counsel these people. Amongst the many people I've counseled have been billionaires, members of the royal family. I mean, I have counseled a lot of people from a wide spectrum of life. And when you look at someone and think, why are you stressed? Why are you acting out? Why are you making all these choices? You have everything that a person's supposed to have to be happy. You have everything. No, they don't. They don't have the most important thing in life. More important than their private jets and mansions, more important than all the friends or parties, more important than all the adventures and success, they're clueless about who they truly are as an authentic spiritual soul. And that's the journey that is worth taking. All other journeys end up at a dead end in emptiness and loneliness and bad choices. So think of how many people in America are stressed because they either keep making the wrong choices out of insecurity. I got to stay in this relationship. Why? Well, I can't afford not to, but it's abusive. I know it's abusive, but I've adapted to it. I got to work in this job. Why? Because it's the only job left in the entire world. There's no other place I could work. If there were, I'm sure I would have been motivated to go try to find it, but this is it, so I got to stay here. But it's unhealthy. I know, but what are you going to do? Can you imagine the excuses that come forth, no matter how inane, from our subconscious? And that creates a stress, because the other side of this equation is, once you make a choice that you know at your core level, your authentic self knows you have lied to yourself, you're self-sabotaging, you got to live with it. But you can't. Nobody can ever live with anything they've done wrong. It is there. What do you think post-traumatic stress disorder is? Do you have any idea how many hundreds and hundreds of vets I've counseled and say, why do you feel you're suffering from this? Man, it's what I saw, or it's what I did. Was it wrong? Yeah, it was wrong. It wasn't wrong in war. I'm not being punished for it. No one's going to do anything to me about it, but morally I know it was wrong. And I can't shake it. I can't get it out of my mind. I did something that ended an innocent person's life. I did something that, you know, hurt a person. I don't know how to handle that. And of course, what do we do when they come home from war? We do nothing. We put them in jail. We give them psychiatric drugs. And then they commit suicide, 23 a day. We do everything wrong. I don't know if we ever do anything right when it comes to understanding the consequences of misbegotten actions. If something is fraudulent, at any point, the entire thing becomes fraudulent. That's a hard lesson for us to learn. That we can't wrap our minds around. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to find the clean water in a dirty toilet bowl to drink. Try it. And that's how we justify, well, the person may be a bad person, may be criminal in his actions, may be unworthy of our attention because he cheats on everybody and his wife and his kids. But still, you know, we're all part of it. No, we're not. If it's corrupt, it's going to be corrupt many different ways. You know, I'm hungry, so I got to eat this junk food. No, you don't. You know, I'm not the one driving the train to the concentration camp, but you're still a part of it. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. You're a part of it. 50 million Germans were a part of it. No, we weren't. Yes, you were. No, we weren't. We didn't. Yes, you did. We just can't deal with that. We have a hard time dealing with it. I just work at Goldman Sachs. I just work at Citibank. I just work with the Justice Department. I just work with the police department. But you know about things that are wrong and you didn't challenge it. But it wasn't me. I'm not a part of it. Yes, you are. Yeah, you are. But you may not acknowledge it, but your subconscious is telling your conscious, deal with it, and your spirit is saying, how can I? It is a truth that I will not abandon, and I will not embrace your lie. That may or may not make sense to many of you, but that is what's behind so much of our stress in life. So much. Making wrong choices, supposedly for the right reasons, and then realizing at a spiritual level, we made the wrong choice, then trying to find a way to emotionally, intellectually adapt to it. It's easy intellectually to adapt to anything in life. After all, just remember, there are Republicans. So it's easy in corporate Democrats. Think of those morons and how they've adapted their logic to whatever they do, no matter what the consequences are for anyone else. So that's something that these villagers were experiencing. And it took a group from Colorado State to go there to do this research to see how damaging displacement is. Now, my final thought, if it's that displacing, damaging to Indians moving from their tribal home to a different location, imagine what the stress is and the telomere is and the aging is and the diseasing is for 9 million American families that were told, get out of your house, it's repossessed. And imagine what it's like for 27 million Americans who were told, you may have worked here and been a good person, but we've got to get this company over to China or India, so we're closing it down. You're being fired. Or we have a new system. You're making $100,000. You've been a loyal employee. You've gained seniority, but that's not profitable. We're bringing someone in from India who's got a PhD, you've only got a master's degree, you're making $100,000, they're going to make $30,000, and we don't have to worry about benefits or unionization, you're out of here. Or what about people who've been relocated out of a relationship? So if you have a truth, it is a universal truth. So this displacement, this not caring about the consequences of moving a group of people must also be taken down to the micro level of what a person goes through when they're displaced. And we have massive displacement, incarceration, not just for the people in the prison system, but also the family members who have to readapt. And we don't care about them. After all, the jailer, the judge, the prosecutor, the self-righteous legislator says, rot in jail forever, you sinner, you smoked weed. They're going to say, I didn't rape the guy in jail. I didn't give him disease. I didn't beat him. I didn't force him into a gang. It's not my responsibility. And I'm going to say, yes, it is. Just like the good German, yes, it is. You're also responsible. We are all responsible for everything we do. It's just we haven't matured enough to take that responsibility. Next issue. Low vitamin D may help prevent and treat diseases associated with aging. Now, this is a good study. This is from Loyola University, their health system, and it was published in the Journal of Aging and Gerontology. And what it says is that if we take vitamin D, then we're going to be able to age better and not suffer from any of the conditions that normally we would suffer from because it's such a broad spectrum healing nutrient. Now, a lot of people just get poor skin absorption of vitamin D. They put so much sunscreen on, you block vitamin D. That's the irony. People all over Florida and Southern California and Texas and Arizona and Nevada and New Mexico, they get a lot of sun, but they don't get sunburn, so they don't get their vitamin D. Isn't that ironic? And yet, the amount of vitamin D that we're told we need is too little. We're told we need 800 units a day. That's according to the Institute of Medicine. And 600 vitamin D for adults and over 7,800. That's wrong. We need now a new study has shown from University of California, San Diego, that that's wrong. We need about 5,000 or more units a day. So we've been getting too little vitamin D. And by the way, from University of Iowa, a good study, better breakfast, better grades. A new study reinforced the connection between good nutrition and good grades, finding that free school breakfasts, which we should have in every school, help students from low-income families perform better academically. When I was studying the habits of people in other countries, in Spain, Italy, France, to the United States, and especially in the South, the way people in the South eat breakfast is just an abomination. I mean, it's a wonder they have a lifespan at all because it's all junk food and lots of it, lots of deep fried foods. Whereas you ought to see a school lunch in Italy or in Spain. It's actually healthy. And in France, they actually give gourmet meals to their kids. But even at home, they're very conscientious to get that child started with a good, healthy meal. We don't in the United States. Whatever's advertised on television, that's what we give our kids. Big mistake. Now, there are millions of American families who are very conscious and very dedicated to getting only the best nutrients in their kids' bodies in the morning. And it's growing. That's the good news. Millions and millions and millions of kids are getting healthy because their parents are conscious, but it's not the mainstream yet. But still, it's important. So the lesson to take away from here is get your kid a good quality, wholesome breakfast, preferably some fruit, some whole grain like oatmeal, and a non-milk like an almond milk, and mix all that together, some walnuts, and that's a good way to get started. Also, new research from the Journal of Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics shows that the omega-3 fatty acids can help fight prostate cancer. Good study. Quote, but we're the first to show that they work, meaning the omega-3 fatty acids, in this way in cancer, said Professor of Pharmacy at the Washington State University. So if you have prostate cancer, make sure you're getting about 3,000 milligrams a day of the omega-3 fatty acids. And a separate study from the Journal of the National Cancer Institute found that men with higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids in their blood had a greater a protective effect. So make sure you're getting that. And longer duration of breastfeeding linked to higher adult IQ and earning ability. This is from the Federal University in Brazil. Quote, longer duration of breastfeeding is linked with increased intelligence in adulthood, longer schooling, and higher adult earnings. And this was following 3,500 newborns for 30 years. It was published in the Lancet Global Health Journal. So breastfeeding, and of course, to be healthy and then breastfeed is the ideal way of immunizing with natural immunity your child. From Harvard Medical School, a pinch of baking soda for better vision. Well, we know it is bicarbonate. Baking soda makes sparkling water sparkle, causes bread to rise, absorbs odors, and put a little box, I do, in the refrigerator, absorbs odors. But it can be used for cleaning all sorts of stuff, including your teeth. In the body, it plays essential roles in buffering pH, aiding in digestion, neutralizing lactic acid produced during physical exertion. But much of the bicarbonate in our bodies comes from carbon dioxide, which is produced as a waste product in all cells, although some is ingested with carbonated beverages and certain types of food. Now, a new study from the Eye and Ear Harvard Medical School describes how bicarbonate also alters how we see by modulating the visual signaling generated by rod and cone photoreceptors that detect light. The study is described online in the Journal of Biological Chemistry. And just so you understand, within rods and cones, a small soluble molecule, the GMP links photon absorption to the electrical activity of the photoreceptor. And in the light, this GMP is destroyed and ion channels are closed. So, anyhow, this is where bicarbonate comes in and limits the size of the photon response and quickens its recovery. As a result, sensitivity to light is slightly lower, but our ability to track moving objects is improved. So that's good. Just a little piece of information that adds in to make a difference. I'm Gary Nall. Going to share a test with you now. And take a look at the latest statistics from the Educational Testing Service. They measured young adults, 20 to 34, that's the millennial generation. And they looked at every single industrialized nation in the world. And we rank dead last. Dead last. Now, how's that possible? Well, the Educational Testing Service and the American Millennials, those who have a four-year college degree, are going to be measured. And this is amazing. A four-year college education is equal to a high school education in Japan, Finland, and the Netherlands compared to the United States. So after we graduate from high school and have 4 years of college, we're just equal to their high school graduates. Americans are lagging, and it's really bad. So I'm going to give you the latest statistics on this. Quote, half of American millennials score below the minimum standard of literacy proficiency. Well, the results were even worse in numeracy, with almost two-thirds of American millennials failing to meet the minimum standard for understanding and working with numbers, and that placed U.S. millennials dead last for understanding numbers among 22 developing nations. Also, quote, after 2 years in college, 45% of students showed no significant gains in learning. After 4 years in college, 36% showed little change. Students spent, quote, 50% time, less time studying compared with students a few decades ago. And 35% of students spend 5 or less hours a week studying. How in the world can you go to college and not study 1 hour a day? But they're doing less than that. And, quote, 50% of all students said they never took a class in a typical semester where they wrote more than 20 pages in the entire class. 32% never took a course in a typical semester where they read more than 40 pages per week. Wow. Okay, test time. Here we go. Got a simple test for you. Let's see how you do. This is from the eighth grade examination for Bullitt County School. All right, just give you a simple one in arithmetic. Find the cost at 8.5 cents per square yard of calcimony, the walls of a room 20 feet long, 16 feet wide, 9 feet high, deducting a door 8 feet by 4 feet 6 inches and two windows 5 feet by 3 feet 6 inches each. That's simple. Let's see if you can do it. A man bought a farm for $2,400 and sold it for $2,700. What is the percentage he gained? Find the amount of 50, that's too difficult. A school enrolled 120 pupils. The number of boys was 2/3 the number of girls. How many of each sex was enrolled? How long a rope is required to reach the top of a building 40 feet high to the ground 30 feet from the base of the building? How many steps, 2 feet, 4 inches each, will a man take in walking 21.4 miles? At $1.62 a cord, a cord's a cut of wood, what will the cost of a pile of wood 24 feet long, 4 foot wide, and 6 feet, 3 inches high be? Okay, those are relatively simple. Let's see if anyone gets them. Grammar. How many parts of speech are there? Define each. Define proper noun, common noun. Name the proper properties of a noun. What is a personal pronoun? Those are just some of the questions. Let's see if you can get them. Eighth grade examination, 1912. That's what they were learning in 1912. What do you want to bet that most PhDs couldn't get any of those in 3 months of studying? God, we are dumb. Whoa. And Coca-Cola is caught paying health leaders to say soda is a healthy snack, isn't it? Did I wake up and forget that Coca-Cola wasn't healthy? Quote from Anthony Gucciardi. Would you like a healthy dose of high fructose corn syrup with that organic salad? If you're listening to one of the health experts on the payroll of Coca-Cola, this suggestion could be, in fact, a reality. According to a new report, many health writers, bloggers, and spokespeople are being compensated in order to push toxic soda onto the public as a health drink. The news comes as somewhat of a shock only due to the severity of these claims. We've known for quite some time that many bloggers are oftentimes quite obviously paid off by mega food corporations to spit out propaganda into Google and other search engines in order to divert attention away from more negative stories. In fact, some companies are paying millions to clean up their food image on the web. After all, it's disconcerting to see results regarding the deadly effects of high fructose corn syrup when searching about information on Coca-Cola's many effects on the body. Released by the Associated Press, a new report has been made public regarding the deep relationship between beverage giant Coca-Cola and the numerous health experts who recently suggest that drinking Coke could be part of a healthy diet. Best of all, this was in celebration of American Health Month. Well, quote, in February, several of the experts wrote online posts for American Health Month, with each including a mini can of Coke or soda as a snack idea. The pieces, which appeared on numerous blogs and other sites, included those major newspapers, offer a window into the way many food companies work behind the scenes to cast their products in a positive light. Well, any nutritionists or dietitians who suggest that Coca-Cola is a good part of a healthy diet, you could challenge them. You have more than enough information to do so. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to go over now and say hello. Before I go there, I do want to share this with you because I found this really incredible. This is from the Activist Post. Quote, an 11-year-old boy has endured relentless attacks from the government for bringing a leaf to school that tested negative for marijuana. Nevertheless, he was suspended from school for 364 days, charged with possession of marijuana, even after it was proven on three occasions that the plant was not marijuana. On September 22nd of last year, students at Bedford Middle School reported to school authorities that a boy had this leaf. When officials found the leaf, it led to the boy's suspension. And then it goes on to talk about how his parents, who are both teachers, were outraged, and he was kicked out of school. And it was tested and shown to be negative, but they went ahead and prosecuted him anyhow. And he was kept out of school for the year. They even had to bring in a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist said that, you know, this was... He was brought in for substance abuse problems, but he had no abuse. Quote, the psychiatrist found no evidence of such a problem and recommended to the school the boy be able to return. He has started attending a different school as of this week, but remains on strict probation until this coming September. In the meantime, the boy filed a federal lawsuit against Wilson and Callahan, claiming malicious prosecution and violations of due process. So, there you have it. Just another example of what happens. And also, California is turning back into a desert, and there are no contingency plans, by Mike Snyder, economic blog. Quote, once upon a time, much of the state of California was a barren desert. And now, thanks to the worst drought in modern American history, much of the state is turning back into one. Scientists tell us that the 20th century was the wettest century that the state of California had in 1,000 years. But now weather patterns are reverting back to historical norms, and California is rapidly running out of water. It is being reported the state only has approximately 1 year supply of water left in reservoirs, and when the water is all gone, there is no contingency plans. Back in early 2014, when Governor Jerry Brown declared a drought emergency for the entire state, but since that time, waste usage has only dropped 9%. That is not enough. The state of California has been losing more than 12 million acre-feet of total water a year since 2011, and we're quickly heading towards an extremely painful water crisis unlike anything that any of us have ever seen before. But don't take my word for it. According to the Los Angeles Times, quote, the senior editor, it is the senior water scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Caltech, and a professor of Earth Science Systems, University of Irvine. So, California, you got a year left of water, then you got serious problems. What they will be able to bring in, not from reservoirs, because they won't have any reservoir water left, will be whatever comes from your runoff, from the drainage from the snowpacks that will melt, but you have fewer snowpacks and you don't have the amount of water. So the richest or those who can afford it will get what is available. There will always be some water available, but not for the farmers, not for the middle class, not for the poor, and not for the communities that are not immediately in the Los Angeles and San Diego and Los Angeles areas. Everywhere else there's going to be severe water restrictions. So all those beautiful lawns, they're gone. All the washing your cars and all that, gone. So you have 40 million people living in the state of California right now. And in some rural areas, reservoirs are already bone dry. In other areas, the water quality has gone way down. For example, in one Southern California neighborhood, black water is now coming out of the taps. Quote, residents of Southern California neighborhood are concerned about the fact that the water flowing out of the taps in their homes is the color black. That's right, the water coming out of their faucets is indeed black, not gray, not cloudy, but black, inky, opaque black water that the water company says is okay to drink. Those who live in Gardena, California, are understandably skeptical when asked to consume. How could you? Who would possibly be? Yeah, you can drink that black water. Take a bath in it. Yeah. That, let's see how your clothes come out after you wash them in that black water. Something happens when people move to California to live there. Something is not natural. Well, anyone who believes anything that any authority says in California, move to Vermont. All right? I'm Gary Noll. Let's go over and say hello to someone who's up in Vermont. Ben Hewitt. Nice to have you with us today, Ben.
Hey, Gary. Thanks for having me.
I gave your background bio a little earlier. Now, although you had already had the opportunity to grow up and experience life in the countryside before undertaking your own homestead project 17 years ago, more and more people living in urban and suburban America are toying with the idea of escaping the economic and social stresses that go with living what has become corporate-dominant America, to transferring, as you have, to a more healthy, self-sufficient life in a rural environment. It's not infrequent that we receive correspondence from listeners inquiring about homesteading, and particularly where to live in the U.S., given the growing threats from climate change and global warming and resource scarcity. For most people contemplating a shift to this kind of a self-sufficient lifestyle, legitimate fears of climate change impacts and further decay and over-government domination of urban cities and towns is primary. And today, the majority of Americans live in urban environments. According to latest figures, 80% of Americans live in urban environments, and only 19% live in rural communities. Therefore, for most people, making the transition from an urban to a rural life is going to be very challenging. So I'd like you to begin with you sharing what you perceive as the fundamental questions people need to ask themselves before attempting to drop everything and move and live in the country. The forum is yours.
How long do we have?
1 minute.
1 minute. Okay, the fundamental questions. Okay, I would say fundamentally, are you ready to commit to daily physical labor? I think that's a really, really fundamental question. And I think that a lot of people sort of look at this lifestyle and with a, you know, sort of romantic eye with rose-colored glasses. And indeed, you know, we love what we do, and including the physical labor. But it is a very, very sort of labor-intensive lifestyle that requires physical exertion on a regular basis. And, you know, culturally speaking, we are not a people that are accustomed to that in the way that we were, you know, 100 or even 50 or, you know, maybe even 25 years ago. So I think in some ways that can be really, really eye-opening for people. And it's just something that I think people need to go into, you know, just being really, really aware of.
Okay, that's good. The rapid pace of American life in competition instead of cooperation, the high cost of living, especially when you have so many people wanting to be in an environment that they can't afford. Mm-hmm. I see it in New York. New York City used to be a middle-class environment with certain areas, Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, Riverside Drive, Central Park West. But for the rest of the city, Sutton Place, for the rest of the city, you know, you could be a middle-class working person and have your whole life a quality of life, including inexpensive Broadway theaters, restaurants, and movies, etc. Not today. Everything is expensive today. And yet a lot of people insist upon living there, sometimes two or three to an apartment, or where their parents are paying for a little tiny closet. I think it was a closet that someone made into an apartment.
Right.
And yet they can't afford to enjoy much of what makes a city special. This is also true for other communities as well, not just New York City. That creates stress. So Americans are more addicted to antidepressant drugs, anxiety drugs, than any other nation in the world. And a large reason is because many Americans no longer live a life with purpose and meaning. I discussed this at the beginning of my program, where I don't believe we should be compromising on certain principles. And one of those principles is, if you are given A, that you can make money, but you're going to compromise your health or your integrity or your values, my suggestion is Find another way to make money, but don't compromise, because though you will compromise, you will find ways of justifying it. You're going to be stressed. There's going to be an imbalance there. Or many people find meaning in pursuing stressful lives to reach and achieve cultural expectations in a market-driven economy. And when they finally get there, there's no there. There's just one big emptiness. So they think, my God, I've worked so hard to climb this mountain. I'm on top of the mountain. No, you're not. You're on a ledge, and there's 3,000 more feet to the next ledge. And you got to do it without ropes. So we stress ourselves to the max every day. So then talk about what it means. You just mentioned working. Yes. But what it also means on other levels, where you're going to decompress. You're going to be near nature. You're going to be doing self-sufficient things. You're going to see your first tomato grow, your first lettuce come out of the ground. The joy you have at seeing that experience, seeing bees and butterflies and wonderful changes of season. Discuss that also, please.
Well, yeah, I mean, sure. And it's a huge part of what draws us to this life. And I'll share one other, really telling statistic with you, Gary, regarding the health of our nation, the psychic health, emotional health of our nation, which is that America comprises 4.6% of the world's population, yet consumes 80% of the world's pain medication. So we're in a tremendous amount of pain. Maybe even some of it is physical in origin. I couldn't agree with you more. I think in so many ways we have sort of sold ourselves short, in pursuing this sort of endless treadmill of material and asset acquisition, which we, for some reason believe is somehow going to make us feel contented and happy. In a lot of ways, you can't really blame people for that, because it's all we are told and sold, and this is particularly true, I think, when you live in an urban environment where you are just surrounded by that messaging almost, 24/7 or literally 24/7 probably. So for us, and I did speak of the physical work and sort of suggesting that people want to be prepared for it. What I didn't say is that, that physical work is, I think part and parcel of a meaningful and healthful life. The ability, our bodies were meant to be used. And not just our bodies, but our minds. I think a lot of people look at, sort of work on the land as being sort of drudgery. But there is a need for sort of constant resourcefulness, for observation, we do a lot of work with animals, for having a really close connection with our animals and observing them, for observing, how our crops are doing. And there's also, this relationship that you have to the seasons, which has almost totally been lost in contemporary America. We look at, the first snowfall in contemporary America now, we think of it as just being sort of a hassle, something we got to scrape off our car windshield, right, but when you live, sort of with the land, I'm fond of sort of saying with the land rather than on the land, because I do feel like it's a relationship, sort of more than a hierarchical relationship. It's a mutual relationship more than a hierarchical relationship. So when you live with the land, your awareness of the seasons and of weather and of climate are so heightened, and that's just an incredibly fulfilling way, at least for us it is, maybe not for everybody, but at least for us it's just an incredibly fulfilling way to go about our days.
Let's go through a list of the major challenges that any individual or family would meet when they want to make a move to a homestead.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the first challenges is financial. I think people have this sense often when they want to move in this direction of sort of wanting to turn their back on the modern extractive, exploitative economy. I'm right there with them. But of course, the reality is that you still need to figure out some way to have some moneyed income. So, finances, I think, are a big challenge for a lot of people. Now, some people are able, they have those resources that they've inherited or earned, and they have the resources necessary to set themselves up and to live, a very humble lifestyle, and, all the more power to them. For us, we did not come to this with those resources, so we are still in a position of, sort of working on a day-in, day-out basis to meet our money needs, although I like to say that, you know, a lot of our income comes from the money that we don't spend rather than the money that we need to earn. So there's that. You know, certainly there's a skills gap in this nation, in our society, and I think that's really, really daunting to a lot of people. Although I will say, you know, that nothing we do here, you know, is rocket science. It doesn't require... you know, we're not craftspeople. You know, we are very much generalists, and a homestead needs a generalist. You don't need to be an expert at anything or everything. You do need to have a willingness to roll up your sleeves and a capacity to sort of think outside the box and to try to solve problems as they crop up. So I think the skills gap is tricky. I think some people are challenged by what they perceive as sort of a culture gap, and this is probably particularly true if they're coming from an urban environment. You know, how am I going to go and how am I going to fit in to this rural environment where I might establish this homestead? How is that culture going to, are they going to embrace me? Are they going to reject me? I see a lot of sort of uncertainty around that and sometimes sort of self-consciousness around that. And I think anyone, just the fact that someone is maybe aware of that is a really good sign, you know, if they're coming into a community that is a sort of tight-knit rural community. And so just having an awareness of that is really, really important. But also, you know, I think understanding that, yes, it is different. I mean, we live ourselves, 30 miles away from what would be considered any sort of center of, cultural center. And so there are certain things that... are going to have to slide down the priority list if you're wanting to move in this direction. And if you're coming from an urban environment and you're accustomed to having access to those things on a 24/7 basis, that can be, I think, a little bit of a rude awakening.
You can also plan in such ways that when you move into a rural environment. I do. There are times when I go to my rural environment where I won't go off the property for a month.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Not at all.
Right.
I won't go anywhere.
Right.
Because you plan everything, you have what you need there, and how I get to know my neighbors is I wait till a season comes, and then I'll take a bushel basket of fruit, maybe some peaches or whatever, pears, whatever's in season, to them and just leave it at the door saying, your neighbor.
Right.
That's all.
Yes.
And then sooner or later, that person pops around and says, well, I just got this from you. I want to know who you are, what you're doing, why'd you give me this? And then
right.
You have a chance to talk with them just as a human being.
Yeah, and I think generosity and humility are like the two, you know, the two keys. I think as they are anywhere, I guess, really, right?
Identify as a human being.
What's that?
Identify as a human being, because
exactly.
People in the countries are going to judge you as a human being, not if you're a lawyer, a doctor, engineer. They don't care.
That's right.
They don't care how much money you make or what firm you're part
yeah.
of, or, you know, or what school you graduate. They just care, are you a nice neighbor?
I have found that the stereotype of the sort of reticent, rural farmer or old timer is largely a falsehood. And it really, that said, I did grow up in Vermont. So, I have that in my favor in that regard. But generally speaking, I have found people in, you know, at least rural Vermont to be very accepting of those from, quote unquote, outside.
They are everywhere. If you're in North Carolina, there's a very progressive community there. If you're out in Boulder, Colorado, that area north of Boulder, progressive people are going to be thoughtful. They're going to say, what can I do for you, neighbor? You know,
right.
If something happens, they're going to be the first to show up. And people never forget that.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
yeah.
when the electricity goes off, but you had solar, so therefore you still have electric power or you have backup propane, and you go to share, say, hey, I saw your lights are out. You know, can I help you with some water? Can I store some of your food in your freezer? I got an extra freezer. They never forget that.
That's right.
But if
and,
you act at pompous or you come on political or come on, you know, with some form of ideological reference point that's self-righteous, you will be rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And rightly so.
Yes, I agree. I mean, it's very much, you know, I find a sort of, although I think a lot of these sort of rural communities are in some way would be politically considered a little bit more conservative leaning. I've also found it to be very much a sort of what I consider to be an old school conservatism of sort of live and let live. And in some ways, very embracing of people, you know, with different ideas.
99% of the people that I meet and socialize with and have a conversation with in rural environments, the primary thing is they want to be left alone.
You got it.
They don't want the government coming in and telling them what to do and you know, what they can and can't do with their lives.
That's right.
And that is a common denominator. So I appreciate you coming on and sharing this because I believe that the movement back to the land is going to be the biggest single social movement in America in the next 5 years.
Well, you could be right. I mean, you know, people do seem to be, eyes are opening. Let's put it that way, Gary.
Well, I know people that don't want to be a part of the environment because they can't afford it, or it's too stressful, or it's too polluted, or it simply is not spiritually or emotionally or intellectually stimulating anymore. And they want to get to an environment with other people of a like mind and share. And that also includes a lot of older people who don't want to get old and die alone. They want to be around other people they can share things with. And a lot of younger people don't want to sit around in the vacuousness of a texting culture. They want to get to do things that you can on a farm that you can't in the city. So for all these many other reasons, people are moving to homesteads. And Ben, thank you for being out there to let people know you can do it. You can succeed. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of effort. You got to be physical. You can't be lazy. No one else is going to do it for you. His book is The Nourishing Homestead, One Back to the Land's Family's Plan for Cultivating Soil Skills and Spirit. The website is Ben Hewitt, Hewitt.net. All the best to you, Ben.
Hey, thanks. You too, Gary.
And we're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.